Most archaeologists or most Dead Sea Scroll scholars, because it is written the way it's written and there's nothing fanciful about it, there's nothing that feels like a myth about it, they think that it is authentic. They think that it's connected to the Jewish temple, but they didn't know what to do with it because it felt so incredibly specific to that time period that it was almost as if whoever hid these items was writing a little notation to themselves after they got back from exile, how to go back and find these treasures. And it would be impossible for us to read today. So there have been a few people before who have gone after the Copper Scroll treasure, but none of them were able to seal the deal.
Welcome to Along the Way. I'm John Matarazzo, your host and fellow traveler. Thank you for joining me along my way as I try to become more like Jesus every day. My journey in this Along the Way conversation connects me with Shelley Neese, the author of one of my favorite books that I read in 2019, The Copper Scroll Project. It is an awesome true story of a real-life treasure hunt of biblical proportions. If you've ever wondered if there really still is ancient treasure buried out there, then you'll want to hear more of what Shelley has to say. I'll get to that in just a moment. I'm so excited to find out when people are listening to this show. I pray that it blesses you, as it has my life. If you've been listening to Along the Way for any length of time, you might have picked up that I was a missionary for 8 years with a group called Youth with a Mission. I haven't been a full-time missionary since 2011, but I still have a huge heart for Jesus' great commission, to go into all the world and preach the gospel. I've been working and producing TV professionally for almost 8 years now, and I have not been able to go into all the world like I used to, but that desire is still there strongly. Every time I look at my podcast host website, I can see that Along the Way is doing something that I can't. It is going all over the world in ways that I can't even imagine. As of this episode, Along the Way has been listened to in over 41 countries. That blesses my heart so much because this podcast is getting to places that I might never be able to go to physically. I'm here in Pittsburgh, and a lot of you listen locally, but I also have a lot of people listening in the Houston, Texas area, and Virginia, Michigan, Oregon, just to name a few, as well as many, many cities around the world. I want to say thank you for listening to Along the Way. I would love to hear from you. Please email me at johnalongtheway@gmail.com and let me know where you're listening from. All of my contact links are in the show notes. I look forward to hearing from you. And now, here's my Along the Way conversation with Shelley Neese. Shelley Neese, it's great to have you along the way. I'm looking forward to hearing more of your story. You and I originally got connected through another guest that we've had on the Real Life program, Doug Hershey. He posted about your book on Facebook. And I said, hey, Doug, would you think that Shelley would be a good guest on Real Life? And without any reservations, he said, absolutely, you have to get Shelley on the Real Life TV program. And you have to hear her story and what she's doing with the Copper Scroll Project. And we'll talk about that a little bit later, but I would really want to hear about your life, Shelley, because it's great to be with you along the way.
Thanks for having me, John. Yeah, no, that's exciting. I mean, nobody ever asks about me, you know, anymore. It's been about the Copper Scroll Project for a while.
Yeah, which is a very exciting thing. So there's a reason that people are excited to talk to you about that. There's more to you than a book that you've written. So
there was a lot of lead up to that, I guess.
Yeah. Just give us a teaser about the Copper Scroll and then let's go back and talk about how God has led you along your journey so far.
Yeah. So the teaser, I guess, the elevator pitch. One time I was actually in an elevator and had to pitch it to CBN in the elevator. So it was a literal elevator pitch.
That's great.
Right. It's a treasure hunt with biblical proportions. So it's about one Dead Sea Scroll called the Copper Scroll, which is a verbal treasure map from 2000 years ago. And the book just follows the journey of the person who is the only one actively looking for those treasures, Jim Barfield.
And it is a phenomenal read. I read it and basically could not put it down last year and said, we do need to get Shelley on the Real Life program. You are just a wealth of knowledge about biblical history and prophecy, but it took you a while to actually get to the place where you are now, where you know all this stuff. Shelley, tell us about your journey with the Lord.
Sure. So I grew up in a small town called Moss Bluff, Louisiana. My dad was a pastor at a non-denominational congregation. I went to Louisiana State University for college, and that's where I met my husband, Brian. And, well, a of course, when we first met, we weren't husband and wife yet. But so I just,
wasn't an arranged marriage. No,
yeah. Exactly. I think one of the most pivotal points in my life was one day. So my boyfriend, who's now my husband, you know, we wanted to get married, but he wanted to go to medical school and I wanted to study abroad. We were 1 year apart in college. So it seems like that was going to kind of drive us away. So we were checking just our college post office boxes. And I don't think that I had ever before read a piece of junk mail or have ever since read a piece of junk mail. But I did that day and he did that day. And it was a brochure for a program in Israel, an overseas program that I would eventually apply to, and a medical school in collaboration with Columbia University in Beersheba, Israel, which is in the southern part of Israel. And so we decided to apply for those programs and we did, and we knew almost nothing about Israel, certainly not modern Israel. We were believers. My husband was a new Christian actually in college, but we really knew nothing about what we were getting ourselves into. But it sounded like an exciting adventure. And so we got married and 2 weeks later moved to Israel. And so I would say that junk mail on that day was a turning point.
So God can speak through junk mail is what you're trying to tell
exactly,
me.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Not to say to encourage you always to read it, but read it when pushed.
Yes. So you got married and then 2 weeks later moved to Israel.
Yes. Wow. Which at the time, you know, getting on the airplane and my mom, you know, up until this point, I haven't lived outside of Louisiana. And here we are moving to Israel for 3.5 years. My mom was crying in the airport and I still feel so bad to this day because I just remember thinking, I felt really big and adult and thinking, why are you crying? This is fine. This is a normal decision. You know? And so now I feel bad about that because now I'm a mom. So I realized how hard that must have been. But yeah, so we moved there for 3.5 years and that was our first few years of marriage.
So you were there for 3.5 years. Mm-hmm. So was that like your honeymoon?
Yeah.
2 weeks later. Yeah.
Yeah. I think we went to Mississippi or something for our actual honeymoon, but then pretty quickly came back, sold all of our stuff, which we were in college. So it wasn't that much stuff and moved and put all of the wedding gifts in my parents' attic. Mm-hmm. We had two suitcases. Oddly, we only had two suitcases that we could bring over with us for that long of time. So almost like no house decorations or anything. Uh-huh. But I just remember that we put a Waffle House menu in the suitcase. And so for 3.5 years, one of our only decorations was a Waffle House menu.
I'm sure that Waffle House is still looking for that menu too.
Exactly.
So what did God do to you when you were in Israel?
When we first arrived, I remember even just being in the Frankfurt airport, because a lot of layovers happen in Frankfurt before you go to Israel and Germany, and seeing all Orthodox Jews get onto the plane. Now, that's not the case for every flight going to Israel, certainly. But suddenly I realized here I am from Louisiana, like have probably known one Jewish person my whole life. And it wasn't until that moment that I realized, even though Jesus is from Israel, I'm actually going to a totally Jewish country.
Yeah, yeah.
And all that meant in terms of, it wasn't until I got on that airplane that I realized I was reversing the situation and now I was going to be the religious minority, which up till that point, I mean, granted, I was a Protestant from Louisiana, so I guess I had been a minority in that way, but nothing like what I was walking into. Even our programs, most people who decide to go study in Israel in their 20s are Jewish, not Christian. Christians go there on programs with their church for 2 weeks or to travel there for a little while, but not to go live and study, because usually that means you have family or some kind of deeper connection. Mm-hmm. So everything changed. Suddenly I'm in this country that I knew nothing about. All of my friends and classmates are Jewish now. My neighbors are Jewish. Even I go to class on Sundays, you know, because the weekend there starts on Friday afternoon and is Saturday, but Sunday is a regular work day. We had a congregation there of Messianic Jewish church, but even in that case, they met on Saturdays because they're Messianic. So okay. Saturday, Sabbath. So it was just suddenly everything changed. Everything that I knew about my own traditions and faith walk and practices. But on the same token, it just felt so alive. The fact that we would road trip to Jerusalem or to the Galilee or all of these places that were now part of our lives, not even part of a tourist trip, was amazing. And it helped me connect with part of my faith and a part of our faith's history that I had never even thought about before, that I had never even considered. And that's that Jesus was Jewish.
Yeah, that's something you kind of forget about sometimes as you're reading the Bible, that Jesus is Jewish. And yeah, that's who he was primarily speaking to, even though, thank God, some Gentiles did get in that story as well. I was just reading this morning about the Gentile woman that was asking Jesus for healing for her daughter. And Jesus basically told her no. And she said, even the dogs get the scraps from the master's table. And he was amazed by her faith. And it's like, oh, wait, yeah, that's a totally different culture that's going on right there. And so just to have real life applications where you have a deeper understanding of something that just kind of just causes the light to turn on for you.
Right. Yeah. And I had never, only reading the Bible there was I suddenly, and granted, I was young, so a lot of your faith is maturing in your 20s, but just realizing, oh, Jesus never actually even left Israel. He says, I came for the lost sheep of Israel. He never left this land. Before he ascends to heaven, he'll commission the disciples to go into all the world and preach the gospel. But that was their job. That wasn't what he did while he was alive and walking this earth. He came for the lost sheep of Israel, and then the message was to be sent from there.
Other than those few short years where he and his family fled to Egypt and then they came back, but he wasn't doing any ministry down there.
And even that is just part of the Jewish story, in terms of the pre-Exodus. So in a way, he was just repeating that Jewish story of exile and then return. So also, I should say that this was once we got there, that's when the Intifada broke out, which was the next 3 years would be suicide bombings and just one of the most violent times in Israel's history in terms of spontaneous, scary terrorism.
Right. What years was that?
2000 to 2004.
Okay.
So it was before, there was no wall back then. And it was after the Oslo Accord. It was just a crazy time. So suddenly it was just a frenzy of suicide bombings. And we lived in kind of an unimportant town. Be'er Sheva is not on most people's radar for Israel. It's just a southern desert town, but it is a university town. But most of the attacks were targeting Jerusalem and Tel Aviv. But there were a few times that the bus that we rode every day to the campus was bombed, not while we were on it. But so it wasn't that Be'er Sheva was totally off the radar. Mm-hmm. But Israel's the size of New Jersey. So a bombing that happens in Jerusalem or Tel Aviv, is felt throughout the country just in terms of everybody knows somebody and it all feels deeply personal.
So we were actually in Israel at the same time. I was there December of 2003 to January of 2004. I was there for 6 weeks.
Oh, that's right. Now tell me, remind me what you were you there with YWAM?
I was there with the YWAM discipleship training school. I was
where? Actually in Jerusalem or where?
Tel Aviv, Jerusalem, Haifa, Eilat.
We were in the important cities.
Yeah. And there was some areas that we had to definitely stay away from and areas that we felt that God say, go to this area, even though it's dangerous, because I want you guys to preach there. And we saw some amazing, amazing things, which I'll share at some other point. But this is your story, not my story right now.
No, but that's amazing. So we actually overlap. So you know exactly what I'm talking about.
Yeah, yeah. You could feel it in the air there, that there's always this tension, this uneasiness of you just don't know what's going to happen. Everybody's kind of a little bit skeptical of other people.
Exactly. Yeah. Somebody gets on a bus in July with a heavy coat on and then everybody gets off.
Yeah.
And that's all terrorism is also just a psychological war as well.
Mm-hmm. You were in Israel for 3 years with your husband. What did God do with you after that?
Well, so when we got there, I'll say that the shift happened that I had always been a math major in college because that's what I felt like I was good at and I'm competitive. So I just kind of enjoyed the competitive nature of math and trying to set the curve for the exams. And I think I understood in terms of God's plan and purpose for me at that time was just you do whatever you're good at. And only once I got to Israel did I realize you know, there was nothing about math that fit other aspects of how I wanted to serve God or just knowledge and information that I wanted to pursue for myself and my walk with God. And so dropping math was a big deal, but with the Intifada going on and living in Israel, suddenly none of that, I didn't care about that. I didn't care about math or science. I wanted to know about what was happening around me. I wanted to understand why this was happening. And so, and there was big gaps just in my education to that point. So I didn't know anything about Jewish history or anything about the story of the Middle East. And so I just started taking every class that I could on those subjects so that I could understand what was happening. And also just understand where I fit in it all and how I thought I was spontaneously just reading junk mail. And now I'm living in Israel during a war and I feel very pulled to the people around me and to the movement that was happening around me. And so a lot of that was dealing with Christian history and dealing with what Christians have done to Jews for 2000 years that I just had never really reconciled before. Yeah. And suddenly all of my friends are Jewish and we're talking about the Holocaust a lot. I'm learning about the Spanish Inquisition and just the Crusades and all of these points in history that Jews were our first target. And trying to just go through a process of repentance and restoration for what all of that meant. In the process of all of that, I ended up graduating in Middle Eastern studies kind of accidentally and going to graduate school in Middle Eastern studies. So I guess the first degree was technically political science, but the graduate degree was Middle Eastern studies. And like you said, I mean, in Israel at the time, it was really tense. Gravity was thicker at that moment. And so even studying the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and all of those things in the classroom with Israelis, because at that point in graduate school, I was studying just with Israelis, it just felt like the most pressing thing in the world. Yeah. You know, it felt, yeah. I just had a compulsion. And I was not good at humanities. I was terrified of writing.
Really?
I just always focused on math. So I had a poor foundation for history and social sciences and still to this day, I'm terrified of writing.
But you do it a lot. Exactly. And you're good at it.
Well, I just feel like if God wants us, I mean, just like with Moses or David or Esther, I think God sometimes propels us towards the things that we think we're bad at or and away from our natural talents. Because I probably would have struggled with humility if it was about math. But as a writer, I just can't get enough advice. I can't get enough direction. It is not a struggle to stay in a constant state of humility when it comes to writing. You know, I feel like everybody's my teacher.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that was felt like I was biting off this thing bigger than I can chew by switching over and suddenly just writing all of the time. And also just all my Jewish Israeli classmates knew things instinctively from their childhoods that I didn't know, you know, so I would come up with these paper topics that were just ABCs to Jewish history, but I didn't know that. I had to start from the beginning. So yeah, it's hard to even just kind of think it all through now, but I know that was a big turn and a big shift. I also was not thinking about what I would do for work after all of that.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, a Middle Eastern studies major seems like, well, that might have two jobs when I move back to the States. But when you're compelled and propelled to do something and learn something, I think you have blinders on towards what the end result is.
Yeah. And also God leads those steps afterwards, even though it doesn't seem like there's any footing there. God's going to make a way. If he leads you in your first step, he's going to lead you in your second step too.
Yeah. What feels uncomfortable is usually the right answer, maybe.
Yeah. In my life, that's just something that I'm constantly having to remind myself that God hasn't led me this far to leave me hanging.
Yes.
Or, you know, given me this experience or that encouragement just to tease me. That's not in his character. That's not who he is. So he knows what my next step is before I take this step.
Exactly.
It's always good to be reminded of that. And even if we need to remind ourselves sometimes. So
exactly.
You've just been talking about finding your purpose a little bit there, because you thought your purpose was one thing, and then now it is something a little bit different. Mm-hmm. Tell me more about your purpose as a writer, as a Middle East studies, as an advocate for Israel. Tell me about your purpose now and how God's led you that way.
Sure. Well, I mean, as you know, like passion and purpose can help overcome our weaknesses.
Yeah.
Whereas I wasn't passionate about math. It just came naturally. So suddenly I found what I was passionate about. And even though it was really hard and felt unnatural, I knew that it felt like an act of worship in a way. So, I mean, still to this day, when I write, because I'm so terrified of it, because I feel so humble towards it, and that it's a gift, and that it has to be God of why I'm doing this. I mean, a lot of times I can't even sit down when I write, especially, I mean, mostly I'm writing about the Bible or Israel or the Jewish people. So it's, it feels like an act of worship. And so it almost feels disrespectful to sit sometimes. Like I get excited and I feel the Holy Spirit writing through me because I'm not a confident writer. So I know that that has to be it. And that's really helpful, you know?
Yeah.
It's a really helpful thing in terms of depending on God, because I actually do need God. He puts these burdens on my heart about what I should share with the church, about how we can reconcile with the Jewish people. Coming away from Israel, I just felt like the Jewish people were our big brother and we were the little brother. And all little brothers want the approval and a relationship with the big brother. And so I just felt like to restore that relationship, we had some work to do. And I loved Israel and I fell in love with Israel, and it was during a difficult time. So I also felt passionate about standing up with the Jewish people and fighting anti-Semitism and protecting the modern state of Israel and all that it was going through. When I came back to the States, I didn't know much about the Christian Zionist world in the States, because at that time I had just lived in Israel. And I started working for an organization. So it was with Harvard Law School, and it was called Conflict Management Group. And so we taught Israelis and Palestinian leaders conflict negotiation skills, because that ended up being my dissertation for graduate school, was in that world. Actually, I wrote about the Church of the Nativity siege that happened there the year before we got there, and just how that was resolved. And so that actually, that dissertation is what pushed me towards this job. But the whole time I was there, I felt like it was Harvard being Harvard, and they were just teaching these dry negotiation skills, the same ones they would teach to business students, to Israelis and Palestinians, that it's actually religion that fuels a lot of these debates.
So
you can't approach Jerusalem as a rational actor the same way you would approach a merger for two corporations. But that's what they were trying to do. It was kind of unbelievable, really. So at some point during that job, even though it was a great job and it was really, you know, always whatever your first job is, you just feel thankful to have it, because didn't look so good graduating with Middle Eastern studies degree. But I didn't feel comfortable. I didn't feel like I was advocating for Israel's interest. I didn't feel like the work was genuine. This is all really mean, because I'm really thankful for those people that hired me. But I did leave that job and went and worked for the Israeli consulate. Which I was the first Christian to get a security clearance working for the Israeli consulate in Boston. And that was really jumping ship, because it did mean that if I had ever entertained a hope of being on that side of like the law side and the conflict resolution side of Israel, then working for the Israeli consulate pretty much would end that, in terms of that I declared a bias.
Right.
But I did. And the bias only got stronger from there. So once we left Boston, because my husband was a student there too, we moved to Charlottesville, Virginia. And then I cold called a Christian Zionist organization called Jerusalem Connection. I cold called their president named Jim Hutchins and just said, you know, this is my background, this is my experience. I love Israel. I only love Israel more every day. And I like what you're doing. Do you need any help? And I was pregnant at the time with our first kid. And so, you know, usually that's not great for a job interview. But Jim Hutchins said, yeah, come on in. And so I started off as editing a magazine that they did. And I had said before I had come back home, because, you know, I was just finished with my education, and I thought, wouldn't it be amazing if I get to write and continue learning about Israel, but do that for somebody? You know, if I get to stay in all of this, but for work. I just thought that idea of that was delightful, which is kind of what you do too. You know? And so that's what I first started doing. So I was the managing editor of the magazine, and later on became the vice president of the organization. And then just last year, the person who hired me, General Jem Hutchins, he retired at 82, 83. Wow. He's our president emeritus now, so still really involved. I'm the president now. So I've been with them for 14 years and just fighting for what's important to Israel, which as of the last year, we've gotten a lot of our, if we had a Christmas list, a lot of that has been checked off.
Yeah. I mean, the embassy moving from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem was huge.
I mean, only a 35-year longing, you know, like in terms of when Christian Zionists helped write the legislation for that was 35 years before it actually happened, which is amazing. So, yeah, I mean, we were all in a hotel in D.C. together, all the Christian Zionist leaders and organizations who had fought for this, including the people who had written the original legislation. And everybody was just crying when the actual embassy opening had happened. We were all just crying. We went there later. I went there with my family this summer for a whole month. And so we visited the embassy, and my husband's military. So he knows that every embassy has a Marine on base, and Marines sell coins, like special designed Marine coins for the embassy, as just kind of a way to support their Christmas balls or whatever. Mm-hmm. So we knocked on the door and we're like, we'd like to buy a coin. So he gave us one, but it was the Tel Aviv consulate. Like it was when it was in Tel Aviv. We're like, no, I mean, we want one for Jerusalem. And he said, come back tomorrow. So we came back the next day and it was fresh off the mint.
Oh, wow.
I mean, it was like the coin was hot, you know? And it was the first Jerusalem embassy Marine coin, which is pretty cool.
That is really cool.
If I had it right now, I would hold it up.
but nobody that's listening to this podcast can see it. Maybe this you can send me a picture of it and I'll I'll put it on the post or something like that.
Great idea.
That's great. So there's some really exciting things happening in Israel and with the Jewish people. We're seeing prophecy really unfolding before our eyes. A few years ago, you came across Jim Barfield and what he has uncovered. Let's talk about that a little bit now, because that Copper Scroll stuff is how we originally got connected.
Mm-hmm. Well, so I did realize, I mean, I said I was the editor for that magazine. I did realize in the course of that first job that I don't really like writing about politics. just the 24-hour news cycle didn't suit me. You know, I think more with the historical lens and framework and brush. So I was writing about things going on in Israel. I'm interested about modern politics in Israel, but I was always trying to write about politics in Israel by connecting it to something in Israel's past. Mm-hmm. And that was what spoke to me in terms of why I'd even pursued the studies that I did. I wanted to connect ancient Israel to modern Israel, just always just tether them and show Christians how one affected the other. But that takes time. You know, not a 24-hour news cycle sort of thing. That's like, I need to think and read and research and study, which was not great for just pumping out an article a day. So I met a man named Jim Barfield at a prophecy conference that I was just kind of visiting to look for stories. There were some Israeli members of Knesset there. And so I was just going to write some political stories. But I met him and started talking to him. And he just was telling me the craziest story. He's telling me that he was a retired arson investigator and that he had always loved and studied the Dead Sea Scrolls, but he had recently taken another look at the Copper Scroll and he thought that he had deciphered something that nobody had been able to figure out for 60 years, which I had studied. I mean, I didn't study biblical history when I was in Israel. I'd studied Jewish history and Middle Eastern history, but so I'd certainly seen the Dead Sea Scrolls, knew a bit about the Dead Sea Scrolls, but I'd never heard of the Copper Scroll. And so here I am thinking like, I've just been living in Israel for 3.5 years. I work for a Christian Zionist organization. Like, I do not know what the Copper Scroll is. So one thing that I do when I tell people about the book is just kind of like lay out in the beginning, you are still a good person and a strong believer and someone very aware of all that's going on in the world, even if you haven't heard about the Copper Scroll.
Right.
because I hadn't heard about the Copper Scroll. And it's a crazy thing that wouldn't come across your radar.
Right. I mean, everybody's heard about the Dead Sea Scrolls.
Absolutely.
They were found in 1948. A Bedouin shepherd just was looking for a sheep, threw a rock in a cave. Whether he was trying to hurt the sheep or find the sheep, either one, he heard, instead of a bleating of a sheep, he heard a crashing of a pot.
Exactly.
These Dead Sea Scrolls, they came to light and they just ended up on the antiquities market. And then people started realizing what they actually were. And now it started this major archaeological excavations and trying to figure out what is really there. And then they almost didn't find this Copper Scroll, though. Can you tell us how that happened?
Right. So it was really a race between archaeologists and Bedouin. Once the Bedouin found the first Dead Sea Scrolls, Bedouin would continue to find the next Dead Sea Scrolls. I mean, they're the kings of the desert. So they just knew. They knew where the caves were. They had heard rumors maybe of scroll cap scattered caves before. And half the time, the most important cave, which is cave 4, they found under the noses of archaeologists digging at Qumran during the daytime. And Bedouins were going and pulling out thousands of scroll fragments from cave 4 at night. So they were good. I mean, they were really hard to beat. But in the case of cave 3, so anytime we talk about the Dead Sea Scroll caves, we talk about them in numbers and according to the order they were found. And so it was Dead Sea Scroll cave number 3, that it was actually a team led by an archaeologist from France named Henri de Contesson. They found this cave that they were really disappointed because the roof of the cave had collapsed in antiquity. It had once been a robust library of Dead Sea Scrolls. You know, those classic jars that hold the Dead Sea Scrolls. So those were in there, but they had crushed, exposing the scrolls inside to just weather and rodents for a couple thousand years. So they saw fragments and rat's nest and kind of littered throughout the cave, but not too much that was still salvageable. And so after it was about a 10-day excavation and it was in the last hours, they were wrapping up. You know, they'd gotten all that they could. It was the last few hours of the last day of the excavation of cave number 3, when one of the people on the team said, I think this is actually a cave complex. I think there's a side chamber. And what they saw was that maybe it was when the roof had collapsed or at some point there was a wall against a side chamber. So in terms of, you know, castle terms, it would be like a false wall, you know, hiding a special nook, but it was natural. It was God created. And so they chipped through the limestone and what they saw on the other side was a man-made shelf, and resting on that shelf were two copper rolls and that was a copper scroll. And nothing had been found like it before or since. So it's really unusual in that it's not like any of the other Dead Sea Scrolls, which are on parchment, papyrus, or leather. It looked green like the Statue of Liberty, and it was just sitting there. We always say copper scroll instead of copper scrolls, even though it was two of them. But we know that it had broken antiquity, that probably when they were rolling it up, it snapped, because it's pretty clear that it used to be one long scroll. Okay.
Interesting.
Which is why we don't say copper scrolls. But it was like 7 feet long and foot wide, making it one of the biggest, most well-preserved of all the Dead Sea Scrolls.
Yeah. So what is on the copper scroll?
It's like an old grocery list. So if you just, you know, let's say that you're somebody, the type of person that has a book of all of the Dead Sea Scrolls translated in English, if you pull out the Copper Scroll translation, it will be the most boring of all of them in terms of that there's no narrative, there's no story, there's no prophet Daniel or Isaiah. Mm-hmm. It is about over 56 locations. So it just reads really dryly. There's no verbs even. So it'll just read like this over and over. It's a verbal treasure map. And it'll say where to go, look, what you'll find when you get there, and how deep to dig. And so it just repeats that pattern over and over. So it'll say like it starts off under the ruins in the valley of Achor. And then it proceeds to tell you that there are steps that face to the east and go 40 cubits. And there you'll find treasure and you should dig this deep to find it. So, I mean, courtyards and gutters and peristyles and cisterns. And so it just has all of these kind of architectural descriptions that it just keeps diving into. And if you don't know where that is, it feels confusing. It feels really, really specific to that time period and impossible to understand in that way.
Yeah. And so this map is out there, or this verbal treasure map is out there, but nobody had cracked the code.
Exactly. People just didn't know what to do with it. I mean, first, it's pretty clear that it must be connected to the Jewish temple in Jerusalem, because it's, if you add up all of the gold, silver, bronze, all of the treasure listed in the copper scroll, it would be the equivalent of 168 tons of precious metal.
That's a lot.
It's insane. And so that's according to what we know that a talent would be. Let's say that even a talent was less in pounds that we translate it to today, which I think we think one talent is the equivalent of 75 pounds. It would still be a ridiculous amount of treasure. So really, the Jewish temple is the only place in Israel that would have had access to that kind of wealth. Mm-hmm. Also because it uses words like sacred, tithe, priestly vestments. So it also uses language that points to the temple. And so most archaeologists or most Dead Sea Scroll scholars, because it is written the way it's written, and there's nothing fanciful about it, there's nothing that feels like a myth about it, they think that it is authentic. They think that it's connected to the Jewish temple, but they didn't know what to do with it because it felt so incredibly specific to that time period that it was almost as if whoever hid these items was writing a little notation to themselves, you know, after they got back from exile, how to go back and find these treasures. And it would be impossible for us to read today. So there have been a few people before who have gone after the copper scroll treasure, but really just three, but none of them were able to kind of seal the deal. They all maybe advanced copper scroll knowledge and research and pursuit, but none of them were able to locate any of the treasure.
So you found out about this because you were pursuing a story through the Jerusalem connection. And you met this retired arson investigator from Oklahoma that changed your life.
Yeah. I was just looking for a break, you know, not to write about politics. So I thought, well, at first I thought he might be crazy, you know, so but he was delightfully crazy if that was the case. Like, I really liked him, but I had never heard of the Copper Scroll. So that part sounded crazy to me. So I thought, I like this guy and I like his story, but I don't even know if the Copper Scroll is real. So I went home and just did a little research, and, you know, you're one Wikipedia search away from finding out that the Copper Scroll is very real and exactly what he had presented to me. Cause I even thought, you know, there must be another version of this. Like, if there was a verbal treasure map from the Jewish temple, I would have heard about that.
Yeah. You would think so.
Yeah, exactly. So then a few days passed and I was just haunted by it. You know, I couldn't read enough about the Copper Scroll. So I decided to write a story about it, mostly so I could just keep talking to him, keep asking him questions.
Yeah.
And so I published that first one actually in Jerusalem Post even. So, you know, it was kind of read by Israelis as well. And then published another article, a longer article. After publishing a few articles, I went quiet and I just kept following Jim, following his story and wondering if I should write a book about it. But I even talked to someone at National Geographic at the time about writing a book about it. And they said, we love this story. We love its flavor. We don't publish things when there's not a find.
Yeah.
So that was kind of the commitment I had made to myself. I'm not going to write a book about this unless they find something, you know? But it was actually after 7 years of being involved in the story and staying really close to Jim Barfield and Chris Knight, who's another person on the team, and Jim's wife, and kind of just everybody involved. I just stayed close to them and went with them to things and stayed part of the story, almost like a historian of the project.
Right.
But so much just happened with the human piece of it all. And I eventually realized that this was a story that had to be written, even without a definitive find, that it was just so insane, kind of how God had directed Jim and what all happened.
Yeah, because when this find becomes public, it's going to change the world.
Right. So I don't want to start writing the book then.
Right. You
know? It's too late.
Exactly. Exactly. So, Shelley, how did you go from being somebody that was interested but skeptical to being somebody that's interested and fully involved with this project?
Yeah. I mean, usually as a journalist, you're supposed to kind of keep a very neutral voice, which I think probably in the first couple of articles I did, But I went with them on an excavation in 2009 to Israel. So 10 years ago, you know, it was probably then that I got on camp goggles. You know, when you're at Christian summer camp, like at first you kind of meet people and you think, I don't really know if these are my people. But then by the end of the week at camp, like you can't believe that you ever did life without them, you know? Well, so that's kind of what happens on digs too. So I went there, there was an excavation in 2009. I'm with Jim and Chris and the whole team. And we just had a ball. I learned so much from them. We would study the Bible together. There's a lot of downtime when it comes to archaeology, or at least in this case, there was a lot of downtime. And so it was a lot of just Bible study and discipleship and just having fun. I think at that point, once they're friends, and also once I'm kind of invested my own time and sweat and tears into the project, it was, yeah, no longer possible to be neutral about the subject. I really wanted them to find something as well.
Yeah.
You know, and really believe that the research is on to something.
Yeah. And you got me won over to that side as well, too.
Everyone starts as skeptic, and I invite that because that's how I started. But even if you stay a skeptic after reading the book, you know, that this is just too unbelievable to be true. I do feel like the book walks people through learning more about the Dead Sea Scrolls, learning about first century Jerusalem, modern Israel. Yeah. And so that's my main goal, is just to get people excited about Israel and the Jewish people and its connection to our roots and to our faith and what all this means and how big God is in terms of what he's doing through archaeology too. And just these little chances for the Bible's historicity to be proven true, but also, yeah, I mean, our God is an intangible God. So it feels very exciting and delightful the times that you get to just, but through archaeology, you know, to touch and feel the God of the Bible through these artifacts.
Yeah. So you've been on an archaeological dig in Israel. Mm-hmm. That's pretty darn cool. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I ate a lot of popsicles. I was kind of just, you know, the historian. So, but it was actually an excruciating experience in terms of all the drama and everything that unfolded, which is too long of a story to tell but it's in the book.
You got to get the book, which I'll provide. Yeah,
but
a link.
It was hard. You know, I'm not going to paint it like that it was all romance. But you know, you actually, I should tell you this. So you have impacted my life.
Oh, really? How? Okay.
Mm-hmm. I doubt you even remember this conversation, but you were just telling me how much you, after you read the book, that, you know, you loved archaeology and that you felt connected to Israel too, and that you lived there, and that you liked this show, Digging for Truth, with Associates for Biblical Research, who are also in Pennsylvania.
Yes.
And so after you told me that, and I'd never heard of them, so after you told me that, I started watching the show and got their magazine, Bible and Spade, and befriended on Facebook Dr. Scott Stripling, which is their main archaeologist who's digging at Shiloh. And Shiloh is very connected to, I feel like, in a way, the Copper Scroll too, just in terms of teaching about tabernacle history, and temple history, and all of that. So then I got really excited about what was happening at Shiloh. And so at first, I decided to audit a class. Scott Stripling is a provost at a seminary called the Bible Seminary in Katy, Texas. So at first I thought, well, I'm just going to audit this class because I kind of want to hear about what's going on at Shiloh. I don't have time to take it for credit, but I'll audit it so I can just hear the stories. And so about a month in, I realized, oh no, I want to do this. Like, I want to do this for credit because I'm realizing what all I don't know, for one, and also just studying under believers archaeology felt really refreshing because I'd always studied in Israel with secular professors. And so I always had to kind of apply like a faith filter to what I was learning.
Sure.
So it was refreshing not to have to do that. So anyways, so basically I'm telling you that because of you and your advice, I ended up going back to school to study biblical archaeology officially.
Oh, wow.
You know, not just reading for the book.
Wow. I mean, you were the one that connected me with Dr. Scott Stripling, and I've had him on along the way.
Right.
It was a phenomenal conversation, a phenomenal episode. I learned so much.
Chilo is a dig to be watching.
Oh my gosh.
You know?
It's fascinating. It's fascinating. Yeah. I felt really excited because I got to have the podcast released the week that everything was made public.
Oh, nice.
All these articles started popping up everywhere, and I was like,
oh
my
gosh. You look so relevant.
Yes, absolutely. So thank you for that connection, but I didn't realize that our little
instigator.
Conversation. That's pretty cool.
It all comes around. Yeah, exactly.
Cool.
That's why you just have to be listening
exactly.
to other believers and what they're excited about.
Exactly. And that's kind of what this whole Along the Way podcast is about, is God is speaking to us through other people, through the Word of God, through our circumstances. God is speaking to us all the time, and He's always leading and guiding us. And I'm grateful that I got to be a part of your along the way journey in that regards. And that's encouraging to me too. Very cool.
Also, big things are happening in Pennsylvania, clearly.
back to what's happening with the Copper Scroll. And I got to get to the point where we talk about the scans, because when I saw Jim Barfield talking about that, I found him on a YouTube video talking about these scans. I was just absolutely blown away. Yeah, not that I didn't believe anything that you were saying. It was just like, oh, this is even more real.
Right. No, data always helps. Yeah. Theories are theories, but data helps reinforce for sure. So from that time, from 2009, it was just a series of stops and starts for Jim Barfield and for his team. A lot of opposition for who he was, for not being an academic, and also the archaeologist that was the head of Qumran, that had been the lead in that 2009 dig, died in a tragic cave accident. And then the other archaeologist who had come alongside Jim in the beginning also died from cancer. And so it was a lot of setbacks. It was a lot of starting over, just even with relationship building. And so it was at one point that it was suggested to Jim to meet with a member of Knesset, Moshe Feiglin, who was at the time Israel's deputy speaker of the Knesset, which the Knesset is like their Congress, you know, it's a parliamentary system. And I had followed Moshe Feiglin just as someone who follows Israel's politics. And I had thought, this is a person who just would have the courage to push past bureaucracy or whatever any of these other hurdles were of hurting anybody's feelings, any archaeologist's feelings or any bureaucrat's feelings. So Jim had the chance to present the research to him in New York while he was there for kind of a rally for his own political party. And I didn't know, I had a positive feeling about just Moshe Feiglin and Jim Barfield meeting. I didn't really know what would come from it. And at that point, a lot of people had come to Jim's aid and had allied with Jim, just religious and political leaders, and hadn't seen much like materialize from that alliance other than that it was nice. Moshe Feiglin said at some point in the presentation, he said, "Wait, when's the next time you're in Israel?" And Jim told him, "I'll be there in a couple of weeks." And he said, "Do you have that metal detector in Israel?" Because Jim had told him, "I have this $10,000 Lorenz metal detector that can tell the difference between ferrous and non-ferrous metals and how deep they are. And so perfect for kind of the Copper Scroll situation." And Jim said, "Well, I can get the get the scanner there." And so he said, "Okay, great. I have something called Knesset immunity. I'm just going to scan it. Let's just do a little scanning," you know, which Jim had for years been trying to, once it was realized that it was going to be kind of impossible to dig at Qumran, which is already a pretty sacred site for Israel and its relationship with the Dead Sea Scrolls. He had been pursuing just doing an electronic survey of it since, after all, the Copper Scrolls like pointing towards metal, that's helpful. So he did. So Jim met him there, Jim's wife and son, and kind of everyone understood this is the moment. Like this is our chance. We can't afford false positives. We hope for no negatives. And so, you know, they had just done everything to prepare and everybody wanted to be there. I was actually in the hospital having my fourth child. So I was like on standby on the phone, kind of hearing what was going on. And although I did get to be there for the initial meeting with Moshe Feiglin. And so, and it just was all happening so fast at that point. So he did, he scanned five of the sites that Jim had targeted, and some of them just, I mean, it was Qumran's tourism hours. Like, it was just in the blatantly, he just walked in and did it.
Oh, wow.
The head of Qumran was friends with Jim and was okay with Jim. And the security guard just seemed to purposefully look the other way. But there they were in broad daylight. You know, Moshe Feiglin paid for his entry ticket with his credit card with his name on it. People were looking at him. Like, I mean, Israel's a small country. You know who's
here. Right, right, right.
So it was very much understood who he was, and that everybody knew he wasn't an archaeologist. But still, so he did the scan, and Jim and his team went down to En Gedi right afterwards, because it's not the type of metal detector that gives you an immediate read. You have to download the data. And so there he was, like, sitting on a picnic bench in En Gedi, and he pulls up each of the sites, and each of the sites had a positive read that something big and something non-ferrous, so gold, silver, bronze, was buried deep underground, both in Qumran and at one site outside of Qumran that Jim had long felt like was connected to the copper scroll.
Right.
And his research pointed to that. So it was just kind of not an aha moment, because Jim had always believed in his research. But if there had ever been any doubt, if there had ever been any confusion, you know, if he had made any missteps, it just felt like, this is real.
Yeah.
This is no longer just a theory. Like, something is there. Right. Also, Jim could have never promised, you know, the Copper Scroll doesn't say that this treasure would still be there. I mean,
exactly.
The Romans or whoever would have gone through the land and they were looking. I mean, they wanted to suck the temple treasury as much as they could.
Exactly.
Use the money to build the Colosseums. So certainly he couldn't say whether or not it was still there. So it also was just very affirming that maybe not all 57 of the hoards are still there, but we at least know 5 are.
Yeah. Like, and those are pretty important ones,
five
too.
5 for 5. Exactly. Exactly. It was some of, like, the most important and biggest locations for the Copper Scroll.
Yeah. So what is keeping these things from being uncovered?
So that's $1 million question. I could probably give a lot of reasons of why I think this is the case, but the most obvious is just bureaucracy. Mm-hmm. The fact that Jim's not an archaeologist, the political situation in Israel has been less than stable, especially 3 elections in 1 year. And also the political situation with it being not Israel proper, that it's Area C, which means that anything that comes out of the ground in that area is disputed property. And that the archaeologists over Qumran have declared it a closed archaeological site. I'm sure Jim is not the only person who is asking to excavate or asking to partner with an archaeologist to further excavate Qumran. So I think they just eventually got so tired of the request. And Qumran has been excavated to the last level of habitation. It hasn't been excavated in the way that the Copper Scroll demands, where you're digging for treasure, because that's not what archaeologists do. So that's the other thing, is that what Jim's asking someone to do occupies this precarious space, because it's not archaeology, it's treasure hunting. I mean, Jim always says he's not a treasure hunter. He means that in terms of he's not seeking these things for himself.
Right, right.
But it's also not archaeology, because this is not what archaeologists do. They don't take an ancient document and go looking for the treasure that it promises. They dig down to the last level of habitation, the last time people were living in a site, and try and analyze its remains, but they don't dig holes based off of treasure map.
Right, right.
That's been hard.
Basically, it's in the Lord's hands of when this comes out.
I think so. He does have the book and just kind of the media that we've done since, and a lot of Israelis awakening to what we're saying and what's going on has been very helpful. And so a lot of people in politics, I'll just kind of be vague about this, because this part is, you know, not in writing, but have come to Jim's aid and have said, we want to help you and we want to help move this thing along from a top down level rather than bottom up, which is what he's always done before. Mm-hmm. But who's in power has been really questionable in the last year in Israel.
Yeah.
So I think Jim has just submitted to waiting that part out. But hopefully, you know, it's the classic kind of like, will friends in high places kind of be able to move this along? I don't know. I hope so. You know, also an earthquake could just kind of do the trick too.
Yeah, but that could potentially damage some things
Exactly. But it is on a fault line. So I have sort of like thought that before of, and there's even proof that an earthquake has happened at Qumran before. Like, you can see evidence of just in the destruction, the way certain steps were destroyed. And and so I have thought about that of like, well, one way God can get all the credit.
Absolutely. It's really interesting to know that, like, you know, when you look at the Bible and you look at prophecy of what is to come regarding the rebuilding of the temple and the end time prophecy and things like that, this could be a catalyst of those things coming to be, or it could be those things need to happen before this could be released. Who knows? It's really in the Lord's hands, and all we can do is pray that God's timing is perfect and that it will be revealed at the right time and that the right people will be able to get those metals out of there, get those treasure out of there and get it to the appropriate places and it wouldn't be stolen.
It's true. I always think about, you know, the prophets definitely point to a time in the future that the Temple Mount will be a source of inspiration and a source of delight, which it's not right now. You know, it's a source of tension. And so I always think about just the timing of these things being revealed. It's probably directly related to the situation on the Temple Mount in Jerusalem. And there's a verse in Micah, the fourth chapter of Micah, that Micah says, in the last day, the mountain of the Lord's temple will be established as chief among the nations, and it will be raised above the hills, and the peoples will stream to it. So even just in that, you know, two-line prophecy, it requires Israel being a modern nation again. Mm-hmm. It requires Jews coming from all over the world back to Israel. And then it requires what happened in 67 for Israel to have sovereignty over the Temple Mount. And so I feel right. like for the last kind of final step in that, in terms of, I don't know what God's timing or anything is, but just in this prophecy, that it'll be chief among the nations, that we will all look towards Jerusalem and that it'll be a source of peace and not tension. And that is definitely not where we're at. So I feel like that's the final piece of the, you know, prophetic pie.
Yeah. Praying for the peace of Jerusalem is a real thing that exactly. we're commanded to do.
So if you could just add into that the restoration of Israel's, you know, yeah, national dowry, I think is what Jim calls it a lot of times, but just that if this is God's bride, then perhaps she needs to come along with a dowry and for that reunification to happen. So we'll see, but the whole process is, I just hope also just a way for people to dig into the prophets and dig into the Bible and just realize like there is so much there. So if you feel like the Bible is something that has grown old or stale to you, it's just because you're reading the same 30% over and over. And the process of writing this book and just thinking about the Bible and Israel in new ways, I mean, there's threads that are there are just amazing. Amazing. And how it all pieces in with archaeology is pretty delightful.
That's awesome. I'm so grateful that you've written that book and exposed me to the whole Copper Scroll project. But back to your personal life. What is the first thing that you remember God speaking to you? What did he say and how did it change you?
Well, besides read your junk mail. Well, oddly, it was just even just where I went to college. Mm-hmm. Well, okay. I hate when people talk about dreams, but because, you know, I'm sure... Yeah. I'm sure a lot of people are going to turn their brains off whenever I bring up a dream, but it's not like I've got tons of them where God spoke clearly to me in a dream, but I have this one.
God does speak through dreams all the time though. It's all throughout the Bible. It's all throughout modern life too. I've had many dreams where I know God has spoken to me through that. So I'm right there with you, Shelley.
Okay. Okay, good. I just feel like it's always like a charismatic litmus test. So I hate throwing it out there, you know? Yeah. So I probably haven't said this too many times. I was really struggling when I came back from Israel because we had been in a Messianic church in Israel, a Messianic congregation. And then, so we were back in the States and just finding a church. So I felt like I had experienced this thing that was huge and mind-blowing just in terms of rediscovering the roots of my faith in terms of Jewish practices and the Hebrew Bible and learning Hebrew and all of these things. So I was just really excited. And then I come back to the States. And so a lot of the congregations that maybe would have been comfortable to me before were no longer that stimulating. Mm. And I didn't like feeling judgmental of congregations or, you know, maybe pastors that weren't filling my spiritual love tank, I guess, in terms of what they were teaching about. And my husband's military, so we move a lot. So it's kind of like I was constantly having to find a new church and a new congregation and place of worship. And so I just didn't like that feeling. I'm a pastor's daughter, so I don't want to feel judgmental of any church. And so I was trying to decide, like, would I be more comfortable in the Messianic movement? Because that's where I was spiritual home for the years that we were in Jerusalem. We were actually the youth pastors at our Messianic congregation in Beersheba. And so then we started visiting some Messianic congregations. And, you know, it's different in the States because mm-hmm. everybody's got to go to, if you're a believer, it doesn't matter if you're like a Filipino worker in Israel or a Roman Catholic or a Christian from Louisiana, like you're all going to the same church because there's only one, and, you know, in terms of like your Israeli town, it's just, yeah. you're a minority. So that was helpful in that I didn't need a choice. But so I started going to Messianic churches, and even though like their teaching was great, I just also didn't feel comfortable or that was the right answer for us as a family. And I'd been nurtured in the church, mm-hmm. you know, in the Christian church as a pastor's daughter, and had a really positive experience always in the church. I know other people, preachers' kids, it can go other ways, but it had been like an incredible place for me to grow and learn. Like, this is what we're struggling with as a family. And also my husband, because he had the same experiences in Israel. Mm-hmm. And in the dream, I was in my father's church. So the church I had grown up in my whole life. I was in the lobby of the church looking into the congregation, but not going in. An IDF officer, like a girl, came up and told me, "You're safe here. Just go up to the attic." And when I woke up, I realized that like the answer to this question I had of where would be our spiritual home now that we were back in the States after this profound experience in Israel was like that we were to stay in the church, that this was what had nurtured and had fed me for my whole life, but that I was to continue seeking this parallel understanding and deeper roots into the Hebrew scriptures and how the messianic thread that wound the whole Bible together. Mm-hmm. And that I was supposed to share that with Christians as a student and as a teacher. That was such a relief.
Yeah.
Because I felt like I could be in both, that the church was where I was going to stay, but that I could bring to it what I had learned and what I was still learning. And so that's been, I mean, that was 10, 15 years ago, but that has been the constant of no matter how, where we move or what we do. Like in my church, when we lived in Charleston, we hosted a vacation Bible school that was Dead Sea Scroll Bible School. So we made caves and we had like a scavenger hunt for scrolls throughout the pews. I taught a class. I go to an Anglican congregation here in Virginia, and I taught a class called Israel Matters. So just mm-hmm. kind of being active and involved with my church, but doing it kind of the only way that I feel super stoked about.
Well, that's good. You found your purpose, and it's great that God spoke to you through that dream. If God would have given me that particular dream, it would have meant something totally different. But he spoke to you in a way that you could understand. And I love that God does that.
Right.
And as we look back at our life, Shelley, what has happened in your life that showed you that Jesus was actually there walking with you, but you didn't feel that in the moment? But when you look back, you realize that Jesus was there.
Well, I feel like I'm not the best in terms of making decisions, you know, that I'll hear God's voice and then make a decision from that. It's usually like I need God to close a lot of doors and then I'll walk through the only remaining open one.
Yeah, you need God to take away all your options. So you just left the one.
Exactly. Exactly. So that's where I feel like I don't deserve any credit in terms of like God's leading and direction in my life. I've always needed him to close a lot of doors and only open one. And so that being the case, I fell in love with a man who wanted to go to medical school. And therefore, this was the only place that I could study abroad and he could go to medical school. So we went to Israel, you know, that I would get one job offer. And so I would take that job offer, or just a whole series of always the path being pretty clear. But what's amazing to me, and this is true with every believer, even in the moment when I didn't feel like God had provided me with a very clear directive, when I look back at my life, you know, just like sitting in airports thinking, should I write a book? I don't want to write a book. You know, and having these struggles and prayers with God,
yeah,
that I can just see his handprint over every bit of it. And so the things that have required the most patience and endurance, like following an archaeological, you know, dig and story that ultimately took 10 years before we had something like really tangible to hold up. I feel like those are the ones where I see God the clearest because it has required just so much patience and waiting mm-hmm. on my part whereas the immediate wins always feel great in human terms, but aren't right. the most clear to me in terms of that God's hand was in it. So clear direction, lots of closed doors, and lots of waiting. And that's how I'm looking back on my life, see God pushing me just yeah. down the path that he had for me.
Well, that's good. So you don't look at closed doors as a bad thing.
No, they are helpful.
You look at them as, okay, God's helping me with this. That's
absolutely
great. Shelley, if you could go back in the past and have coffee with young Shelley, whatever age you'd like to, go back to a period of life where you know that you might have been struggling with something or you just needed some encouragement, what would you tell yourself and how would you respond, do you think?
So for a while living in Israel, I mean, my faith did go through, you know, it wasn't all just a trajectory of growth that I'm getting baptized in the Jordan and, you know, walking the land that Jesus walked. Like, I was also suddenly a religious minority and facing really hard questions from my secular classmates and my secular mm-hmm. professors about my own beliefs. And one of those that really just threw me was that I had never, in the process of discovering Jewish Jesus, I had never really exercised any kind of faith understanding of how Paul was different than Jesus, you know, and that obviously to be a Christian, I believe in the death and resurrection of Jesus and his purpose on this earth. I didn't ever really come to understand that, wait a minute, also a lot of my faith and theology comes from Paul, from the writings of Paul. And mm-hmm. as much as I need to believe in the death and resurrection of Jesus, I also need to believe in the conversion of Paul on the road to Emmaus. You know, that dramatic moment of Jesus showing himself to Paul also had to be very real to me. And I wasn't really, I went through a period that I could defend Jesus to my classmates because to me, there's always been just something so compelling and beautiful about the story of Jesus and the way God yeah. chose to send the Messiah to the world, that was never the problem. The problem was me defending Paul. Hmm. And I just went through a period that I only read the Old Testament and the Gospels and didn't read any of Paul. And I just wanted to see if like my faith could hold without Paul. I know this sounds really strange and almost sounds like an intellectual exercise, but it was a real crisis of faith because Paul gives us so much of our theology. And so what I wish I could tell that Shelley that probably wasted 2 years not reading Paul was to just focus on Ephesians. That it's Paul's book of Ephesians that I feel like his theology and his walk with God comes to its most mature form in revealing to the world how we are supposed to walk with God and how we are supposed to dwell with God and God in us. And just that whole concept of living a life that is holy and pleasing to the Lord through Jesus and through God, our Creator, and with the Holy Spirit. Once I kind of came back and read Ephesians and tried to like reacquaint myself with Paul, I also read a book by Brad Young called Paul the Jewish Rabbi. I think that was the name of it. But he also kind of presents this struggle as it had occurred to him or as it had occurred to his own students. So I don't think it's so uncommon for people that are diving into Jewish roots, but are also maintaining a Christian faith. Anyway, so even to this day, like Ephesians is the book for me that just re-centers my soul.
That's cool.
Yeah. So getting to know Paul again, I should have never thrown him out. I should have just read Ephesians, you know, and that Paul is a incredibly important part of our theology.
Absolutely. He is. And it's interesting. My personal crux of faith happened when I was 14, 15, and it came around the verse, you know, the 2 Timothy 3:16, where Paul says to Timothy that all scripture is God-breathed and useful for teaching, rebuking, correcting, and training in righteousness. And I knew that we considered all of scripture, all of the Bible to be scripture. And so the thing that I was struggling with was, did Paul consider his own writings to be scripture? Mm. I just needed something to validate Paul's writings, see, what Paul was saying to be true.
See, you're much more mature than me because you dealt with this at 14.
So I just needed some validation that Paul Because I didn't think that Paul would be considering his own writings to be scripture. Mm-hmm. That just didn't make any sense. And I didn't even need them to be scripture in the sense of like looking at the validity and the weightiness of the Old Testament. I just needed something else to confirm that. And so I had a conversation with my pastor because I was trying to like just keep my questions internal, but still ask the questions mm-hmm. That were kind of around that to put the things together for myself. And he brought me to 2 Peter 3:15. And it says, "And remember, our Lord's patience gives people time to be saved. This is what our beloved brother Paul also wrote to you with the wisdom God gave him, speaking these things in all his letters. Some of his comments are hard to understand, and those who are ignorant and unstable have twisted his letters to mean something quite different. Mm. They are to do with other parts of Scripture and will result in their destruction." Here's Peter, who was one of the people that actually walked with Jesus, giving credence to who Paul is
and his writings.
And so I was just like, well, I have no more reservations about Paul. I can totally trust his stuff again. So it's interesting that you kind of had this same,
a similar. Although I can't believe,
I
don't think at 14 I would have been able to put that together. That's really, but also I love that your pastor was ready to answer that question. I mean, that was a very thoughtful answer. So see, I mean, so it's nothing Peter wasn't struggling with as well, or at least was aware of other people struggling with.
It's interesting how God, you know, God puts people in our path along the way to help us, guide us along the way so that we are drawn closer to him and we get to the place where we can commune with him. And that's what this podcast is all about, and trying to learn from other people's life's journey with the Lord, the things that we've learned, the things that we've experienced, and how they draw us closer to the Lord. And hopefully by listening more from your story, I can grow as a person and the people listening to this can grow with the Lord as well. Do you have any, in closing, Shelley, do you have any life verses that you would like to share with people here?
Oh, shoot. Well, I mean, now that Micah verse is just in my head. I'm always trying to just put Israel in people's heads and hearts and prayer lives. So, Micah 4:1, "In the last days, the mountain of the Lord's temple will be established as chief among the nations. It will be raised above the hills and peoples will stream to it." Actually named my firstborn Micah. So there's putting some some weight behind a favorite prophet.
Absolutely.
Yeah, Micah just seems like also that he already had a vision and understood that the covenant would be extended outside of the Abrahamic covenant, but it would be extended to Gentiles as well. And he talks about that. You know, he has a short book, but he gives lots of vision for that. So just our inclusion into the covenant and what that means, but it also means caring about the land and the people.
Absolutely. Shelley, can you tell our listeners how to get a hold of you, how to find you on the internet and the Copper Scroll Project?
So Jim Barfield has a website. It's thecopperscrollproject.com. I have a website, ShelleyNeese.com. That's Shelley with two E's. And then my organization is the Jerusalem Connection. And we're TJCI.org. And then the book can just be found anywhere that people get books.
And I'll be providing links for those in the show notes for sure.
Cool. Well, thanks, John. This was awesome. I feel edified.
Oh, good. Thank you. I do too. That's what one of the things I love about these conversations.
Yeah.
Well, Shelley, thank you so much for allowing me to join you along your way.
Thank you.
When you are in search for hidden treasure, you need to look for clues that are along the way. It's not nearly as simple as it might seem, but if you know the right context, you have a true shot for real understanding. When I was a kid, I was convinced that I would one day find buried treasure. There were a few books in my local library that I couldn't get enough of. They had stories of real treasure hunters and maps of their journeys, where an X always marked the spot. I didn't have any pirate-made maps, so I decided to draw my own. The next logical step was to follow said map to wherever it led, and then I would dig until I got tired. My 8-year-old logic was pretty solid, at least in my mind. I had a map, I dug, there should be treasure, but there never was. The only thing that I found was trouble, especially when I didn't fill in one of the bigger holes in the yard. My dad didn't see the hole while he was cutting the grass, and he fell in and broke our tractor. Well, I guess I broke the tractor. I got in trouble and I had to fill it in right away. The reason I tell you this story is because even though it's something funny that I did as a kid, I learned that I can't make my own map and follow it to real treasure. Just because I wanted it to be real didn't mean that my map or the treasure was real. We need to follow a map that is made by a trustworthy map maker. God has mapped out the plan for our lives, but the real question is, are we following his map or the one that we've made for ourselves? My map that I drew with a crayon on construction paper led to nowhere and ended up getting me in trouble. I've since learned to read maps properly. There are keys and legends designed on the map so that if you follow it, you can get to your destination. God has a path laid out for each of us to follow, but we need to decide to follow along his path. I hope you choose to do that today. Even though Shelley was originally skeptical about what she had been told about the Copper Scroll, she kept searching for truth and came to her own conclusion. I've seen the readouts of Jim Barfield's scans of Qumran, and I'm a believer that not only was the treasure there hidden in antiquity, but there is large deposit there today. I hope and pray that that treasure will be revealed soon, but if it is what we really think it is, then this will be an exciting time for sure. I highly suggest reading Shelley's book, The Copper Scroll Project, pretty soon, because you'll have a head start understanding the story when it all comes to light. And of course, it's a great read. I'll be providing Shelley's links in the show notes. Thank you for listening to Along the Way. If you've enjoyed joining me along my way, please share this with a friend who you think will be encouraged by this podcast. Also, please rate and review Along the Way on iTunes. That helps more people discover Along the Way. And subscribe to this podcast on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts. And you can follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and at my website, alongtheway.media. I hope that you've enjoyed this part of my journey, and may you realize when Jesus is walking with you along your way.